You are tuned to KBBI AM 890, and you're listening to The Coffee Table. Today, we're talking about addiction and how the community is working to battle it, specifically when it comes to opioids. And in the studio, we have Mobilizing for Action through Planning and Partnerships, Opioid Task Force Coordinator, quite a long title, Stephanie Stillwell. Thanks for joining us. And Hannah Heimbach with The Bearded Sister, a local peer group working to end stigma that comes with addiction. And thanks for joining us as well. And South Peninsula Behavioral Health Executive Director Jay Bechdahl is also a part of today's conversation. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Thanks, Aaron.
Good morning.
And so first, I want to start with the Opioid Task Force itself. Stephanie, if you just want to kind of start, tell us what it is and kind of what it does.
Sure. So basically, it was born out of a few different things that have happened over the last few years. So as far as MAP, this whole mobilizing action through planning and partnerships, it's a local wellness coalition. Over the past decade, they've been doing community health needs assessments to kind of just assess what are, things that are affecting our community. And all of these assessments for the past three that have been done have shown that the top factor negatively affecting our community is substance abuse. So we've known that that's been happening. And then over the last 2 years, we've had different conversations with different entities, agencies, organizations about things that are happening in this world. And in 2017, we ended up having one conversation at the hospital that I was invited to, and this was about the number of babies that were born addicted and high-risk families that were affected by substance use. And this basically started this conversation about what resources do we actually have in our community and what are our needs and how can we really address this issue. And so we all started to have conversations, and what birthed out of that was I created this Road to Recovery pathway that was meant to identify the resources that we do have to provide that education for the community and for the, you know, people working in healthcare, but also that really showed a lot of gaps that we had in our community as far as for treatment services and recovery prevention. And so from that, we formed the Opioid Task Force, and it's just been alive ever since.
And when you say you made the Road to Recovery, so it was kind of this, I remember that it was this infographic with this road, and kind of showed from, you know, the start of like treatment all the way to post treatment services and all the things that come in between. When you guys started, I mean, what were the biggest gaps that were identified in the southern Kenai Peninsula?
So we have, you know, we had no true detox facility on the peninsula. The hospital has, been doing some detox medically when not medically necessary, but there was limited detox or no detox at all. Then we have no residential treatment facility. There were definitely gaps in access to treatment as far as what we do have here. So, you know, we had, of course, transportation is an issue, and one of the main providers for medication-assisted treatment in our community is in Inilchik. So trying to get people up to Inilchik to access that service. We have no sober living and recovery. Resources are limited. So there have been AA groups here, but there was no real NA or active NA group, and other peer support was just non-existent. So there was quite a bit of work that we had to do.
Right. And Hannah, you and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday. It's not just the gaps that in services that we have, but also kind of, we'll get a little bit to what your group specifically does later, but you mentioned that it's also kind of hard for people that are looking for help to kind of know where to go, like where do you actually start? And especially, I would just imagine with those kind of gaps in this community, that makes it even harder because those services that they are kind of unaware that they need are not even here.
Absolutely. I think there's a real lack of awareness, especially in our populations that are at risk and that are currently struggling. You know, what are my resources? That's a big unanswered question for a lot of people. And then often, I think it's hard for people to know, you know, who do I go to ask that question? You know, A, who has the information? B, who is it safe for me to ask about that? I know I've used Stephanie's, you know, roadmap to recovery and walked a parent or someone currently struggling with addiction through that, just to even talk about what even are those steps and what does that look like on the peninsula.
And Stephanie, you transitioned into the coordination position, kind of leading the task force in 2017. And, you know, at the time, you said the task force direction may have not been totally defined. You know, you knew that there was these gaps in services, that there was a lot of need there. And so what, if you want to kind of explain, like, what was the task force initially setting out to do, and how was it going to kind of intending to accomplish that, I suppose?
Sure. So I think that we identified that there was a need for a group to connect and be able to just work together and increase our collaboration on this issue. And I think that was really the initial intent. And we didn't have very specific direction, just we knew that we needed this increased collaboration and coordination between the agencies and the community. And we also knew that we had these gaps to fill. So,
And I think one of the things that was interesting was, like Hannah mentioned, not only were there gaps in the service, there was gaps in the knowledge.
Yep.
And what we realized that there was a lot of people doing a lot of good stuff around the community, mm-hmm. but no, if you didn't know Hannah or if you didn't know somebody, you were kind of left scrambling on your own.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that Stephanie's really pulled together with the task force is that that monthly connection of what is going on, what's happening, who's doing what, where parents can find each other, where people in recovery can find each other, where service organizations can recognize what they're doing and communicate that out, where people that just in the community that don't know anything can start to learn. And so it really developed out of a bunch of different people trying a bunch of different things, coming together and making those things sound like one big event that's happening in Homer. And I think that's one of the huge components of the task force that really has made some changes over the last couple of years.
Yeah, definitely. Everybody had been previously doing a lot of great work, but that we were working in silos and that we weren't connecting those dots between the agencies or between the community and really linking everything together. And I think one big thing that has come out of the task force is that we've been able to link together and connect and I think that's still continuing to be one of the big.
Yeah, and this might be a good time to kind of pull in Bearded Sister, because that sounds like kind of that being plugged into this of kind of understanding what was going on. Because you, Hannah, you said that you and a group of people wanted to do something at the time, but you didn't know exactly what you wanted to do, and it was kind of the task force that helped you decide more specifically kind of how you wanted to help, at least in some capacity.
Right, exactly. So unbeknownst to us, we were kind of forming at the same time that the task force was. You know, we're a small group of four people, friends and family, that have been touched by addiction in some way and wanted to do something impactful to help our community heal. But, you know, we're volunteers. We're not experts. So we weren't sure exactly what our niche was going to be. And we slowly, you know, realized that we had some skills in peer support and in supporting, you know, a general dialogue about recovery and reducing stigma, all those things. And it wasn't until we plugged into the task force and really learned about, you know, okay, what are the existing resources and where are there gaps, that we were able to take our goodwill and good intentions and capacity and funnel them into some really specific projects that filled the gaps that the task force was identifying.
Right. And if you want to kind of explain, like, what Bearded Sister is and kind of what it does.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, we just kind of, like I said, we're aimed at supporting resources for recovery in Homer and on the Kenai Peninsula and in a healthy community dialogue around support and recovery from addiction. And we started with hosting some community events that created awareness, created a space to talk about those issues between families and neighbors. And most recently, we've started a program in partnership with KBA Marshall Athletics called Fit to Recover. And it's a once-a-week peer meeting where we spend 45 minutes to an hour working out together and then a half hour, 45 minutes in a peer support discussion. And, you know, we've had that going for about a month. It's free. There's a short registration process. But we've found it's been a great tool so far, and we're really looking forward to seeing it develop in creating a healthy activity for people to come together around, and then have some space to be a little bit more vulnerable as well and seek that additional community.
Sure. And when we were talking yesterday, the way you were kind of describing Bearded Sisters, you called it like loosey-goosey, yeah. But you said that it does kind of provide some benefits in that way, in terms of not being this kind of like formalized office building that provides X number of services kind of deal. I mean, and you said that you've received like text from people and you know, like asking what this is and how it can help them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we kind of operate in the relationship space. You know, we can be that informal kind of organic partner to people that are struggling or to families. And since we've started to be more public about that intention, even though it is kind of broad and vague because it's about relationships and connections, and we really believe that's super vital to healing from addiction. But since we've been more public about that intention, and you know, I put my number on flyers and on Fit to Recover posters, I have gotten emails and texts and calls from strangers asking for help. And I've been able to direct them to the next step or just have a conversation about what's going on. And that's been huge. That's been years.
And I think one of the great things Hannah does that is forgotten, especially in the idea of treatment, is Hannah celebrates recovery. And that was a piece that I think, if you look at the roadmap, is also not there. That not just recovery, but celebrating recovery, really huge component of it. I've been in this field for a long time. And Hannah was one of the first people I met that talked not just about getting treatment and getting better, but celebrating the getting better part, which is often forgotten or it gets pushed aside as you start focusing on the next fire you're putting out. And so I think part of the task force and part of what Hannah has done has brought that conversation to the front and allowed more people to show up at the task force meetings that may not, or has allowed people to show up at these different events like at Kurt's Gym and really start participating, not just in treatment, but in recovery and being proud of recovering, mm-hmm. which is a huge change, I think, and it's really important. And it's something that both the task force and Hannah and the Bearded Sister have really made an impact on this community with.
Right. And you mentioned kind of, you know, directing folks to like the next step and kind of that road to recovery map, if you will. But, you know, it sounds like, and Jay, you've been talking a little bit about this in our conversations about having that one door, like someone shows up. And that's been a real big goal of the task force. I don't know if you want to talk about kind of that idea of having, whether they show up at Cicada or show up at the center or show up wherever, if or even come to Hannah, having that one door kind of policy and kind of how that works and kind of what the idea is.
Sure. If you go back to Stephanie's roadmap, the idea behind it is if someone shows up anywhere and says, I would like some help, to be able to get them started on that roadmap at that time. One of the problems with an agency like mine is we're a big agency. We have funding sources. We have paperwork and regulations we have to do. And that is a huge deterrent to someone that shows up and says, I'd like help now. And we say, well, come on back on Tuesday and fill out this paperwork for an hour, and then come back Thursday and we'll do an assessment, and then come back on Friday and we'll see about getting into services. That takes a lot of the oomph out of that process. So one of the things that we really like to see in our community and we're working on in our agency is when you knock on our door and say, I would like help for a substance abuse issue, is to say, great, come on in. We'll get you started today, tomorrow in one of our programs. We'll get the paperwork done at some other time. We'll worry about funding some other time. But right now, let's get you in. Or let's walk down to Cicada. Or let's walk over to the Kurt's Gym. Or let's walk up to the hospital and get you started in treatment right now. Dr. Spencer out of the Ninilchik tribe is in the process of implementing a larger community-based program around that very idea, because it's, I believe anyone that's working in this field knows that that is a huge, important component to getting that service. When someone says, I'm ready now, the services have to be ready now. Otherwise, you'll lose that traction. So that's one of the things we're trying to do, and I know the community is working on it very well, very hard too.
Right. And you know, some of these changes are kind of springing out of just these monthly meetings with the Opioid Task Force and, you know, and kind of grassroots method, I suppose. But, you know, when I remember when the task force first started, they were kind of going on this work group based model. And Jay, you were on the data group, and it was kind of, yes. And I was at a lot of those meetings, and I think the shocking thing, cause we're all, I think, seemingly so tied to data and the opioid issue of saying, you know, X number of whatever is going to display how big of this big this problem is. And if you kind of explain like what kind of data was the data group after, and kind of why it was actually a lot harder to scrape together than you would think.
Boy, I wish I could answer that simply. We were looking for anything that would indicate how big the problem was, how many people are struggling with opioid addiction, alcohol addiction, you know, marijuana, meth, you know, name the substance, how many people fit in that category? How many people are in recovery? How many people use once a week, twice a week? And it really became an overwhelming proposition because there's so much information that you're trying to put together to make an assessment. And the other side of it is that people aren't interested in talking about it. You can't just go up to someone on the street and say, by the way, are you currently using an illegal substance? Check. Thank you. That's one. And on to the next person. It doesn't. And so the gathering the information is a challenge. A lot of the data is gathered by visits to hospitals or agencies like mine. Unfortunately, that data then is 2 years, 6 months, 18 months out of date, because this is a person that's been using for a period of time and it suddenly has realized that they're in trouble, rather than identifying the need at the beginning or identifying the need at the end. The data that's collected by the state is 4 or 5 years down the road. And so you're not getting a clear picture of the current need. You're getting a picture of what the need was a little while back, and it's really hard to track it. I mean, you sat in some of those meetings, Aaron, and we went around and round on where we should be gathering data, who we should be gathering data from, what we should actually be measuring. Should we be measuring usage or reports to the emergency room? Should we be trying to gather information on the types of drugs? And it's all such a difficult crapshoot. Even the needle exchange, which was tracking just numbers of people that came through, couldn't tell us how many needles they were giving out for individuals, because someone came in and said, I need some for my 3 friends. Were they taking them for 3 friends, or they were taking a full amount for themselves? You don't know. And then it was very challenging. And I think as we started that process, the goal was to get the task force in a direction. And I think that was an early stab at taking a direction. And what we realized that wasn't necessarily the direction that we needed to go. So that was part of the process as well.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, just the idea of collecting this data and kind of getting a snapshot in the rearview mirror. But also, I think, if you want to kind of explain, I mean, there isn't, like your agency itself, there's no magical way you can go just search, say, X number of patients we're seeing that are dealing with opioid issues. I mean, if you want to explain the complications.
So certainly too. At our agency, if someone comes in and goes through the intake process, we get the information that they report. So if someone comes in and says, I'm struggling with a depression or a mental illness, we take that at face value, write it down, and start treating them or giving them service. And then 6 months later, we discover or they identify that they are also struggling with alcohol addiction. So we write that down and continue providing that kind of treatment. So you may not know 6, 7, 8 months into service what you're actually treating, what you're actually trying to help with. People sometimes don't know. So we would have that, but even that, as we collect that data, we're simply putting it into a few different piles, male, female, age groups, basic service. Are you here for mental health issues? Are you here for substance abuse issues? Are you here for both? And it wouldn't even break out a specific drug that you might be looking for help with. So even within our own data, we have some, but it doesn't break down nicely and neatly. And the same we found with the hospital. They could tell me how many people came in for treatment or overdosed on something. Couldn't tell you what the substance was and how many times they might have been there. So it's a challenge.
Right. And just in talking to the hospital as well, I mean, it just, you know, it was the first place I went to kind of when I started want to look at data in this town and looking into the opioid issue. And, you know, it got explained to me very quickly that it's sometimes even, you know, much like the center's issue at the hospital, it's hard to know if that arm infection is due to intravenous needle use. It's hard to know if that insomnia is due to withdrawals. I mean, sometimes it's not incredibly apparent. And you mentioned that wasn't exactly the direction the opioid task force kind of discovered to want to go. So Stephanie, if you want to explain, you know, kind of how that's changed and what kind of the method is now. It's not so reliant on the numbers, but really these kind of monthly meetings and these community conversations.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, data is great, but when we couldn't really, it wasn't getting us anywhere, definitely we needed to switch direction. And I think naturally, we just started opening up to listening more to the stories and what people were telling us, because I feel like, you know, stories over statistics can really make more of a difference sometimes, especially when we're talking about these things where people aren't wanting to talk about or, you know, provide accurate information to people who are collecting the data, you know. So we started having a lot more conversations, and through work with, you know, the Bearded Sister and other parent-to-parent support groups and other just getting engaged in the community and meeting people where they're at, just really getting more, having more conversations with the people who are in need of services. And also hosting community conversations has been really helpful to just get more people engaged and talking about this, and following kind of the flow of the energy of where, you know, our community's needs really are as far as what people are talking about.
Yeah. And so you mentioned these community conversations. That's kind of where this is taking place, if you will. I mean, can you explain that first community conversation? Was it the one at Land's End? Was that the first one?
So over the last few years, we've had a couple different types of community town halls. The first one was back in 2017, right around the time the task force was forming. We had some folks from the state come down, from the Office of Substance Misuse and Addiction Prevention. Got it.
Well done.
Yeah. And they came down, and that's when I presented about the pathway, the road to recovery pathway. And so that was a really like super educational presentation. We had about 80 people at the high school. Feedback from that was at the very end, we did have a short play opportunity for people to ask questions, Q&A style, but people felt like their voices really weren't heard. They weren't able to really engage the way they felt like they wanted to. I'm talking about the community members. And so then last year we had an event, Your Voice, Your Community, on opioids and heroin down at Land's End, in conjunction with the state folks as well, which people got to share a lot more of their ideas, their opinions, and their observations, and to share their voice on certain subjects, which was really helpful to, you know, for the state. They were able to use that information and apply it toward their next statewide opioid action plan. So definitely picked up some themes and was able to engage in conversations from that big conversation there. But again, we want to definitely keep these conversations going, and we have another community conversation planned for later this month as well, to just keep the dialogue going and get people talking and engaging and try to reach different people who are not already engaged in the work that we're doing, and get their voices.
When is that event?
That is February 16th. It's a Saturday from 12 to 5. It's going to be at the Christian Community Church, and it's a free event. We're going to have lunch there for
food.
All. Food, yep.
Food.
We're going to have some good tasty treats there, so definitely try to make it open to everybody. I would love to get as many people there as possible.
Great. Well, we do have a caller on line one. Kristen, looks like we got a little feedback there. You are on the coffee table. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I was wondering, where is the money supposed to come from, since I'm under the impression that our current governor doesn't particularly want to spend any money on anything that helps people. He's cutting the school budget, money that, in fact, they've already spent, and that's created a bit of a crisis. And he doesn't really seem very interested in helping people, although he does seem interested in wanting to throw them in prison, which, of course, is another question. The ones who are commit crimes to feed their addiction, is there good training? Is there good help for them in our prisons, in our jails? I can understand we need to do something about it, but it doesn't seem horribly coordinated somehow between the people who go out and give them the antidotes when they over OD, and the police going out and questioning them, like where they got the fentanyl or the heroin that they're ODing on, and how to get them into treatment programs, either through way of just convincing them to go into treatment programs or arresting them and placing them in treatment programs. So I would like to know how all this is going to coordinate up together.
We need to invite you in and join us in this conversation.
Well, thanks for your questions and comments, Kristen. And it sounded like there was a few things in there. And I think, why don't we start with the criminal justice system in terms of what is existing here on the peninsula. And as far as my knowledge goes, there is the Reentry Coalition, which is based in Kenai. And I do know that they're not serving people in Homer quite yet. But if whoever might want to take that, who might have the knowledge on that one.
So, so there, I'm not sure how active the Reentry Coalition is in Homer specifically, but I do know that, you know, a lot of people that live in Homer end up going through the system up in Central Peninsula, as that's where our Wildwood Correctional Facility is. So, you know, I think there is definitely some folks down here that are working to connect those dots and links. And there is a new group, Hope Harbor, that is working to kind of connect the dots between addiction and reentry in our community. So that's something that's really up and coming right now that people are really engaged in or starting to really work on. As far as locally, the police in Homer, the Homer police have been part of the task force and have been really receptive to working with us. And actually, so part of Dr. Spencer's plan that Jay mentioned earlier is really working to connect services throughout all of the community. And so one of the things she's been doing is helping to train and get the emergency department staff wavered to be able to start medication-assisted treatment in the hospital, so in the emergency department. And what that opens up to is working with the Homer police. So if they arrest somebody and bring them into jail here, they can actually take them up to the hospital to get them started on medication-assisted treatment while they're incarcerated here locally, and have a plan to connect them with the provider as soon as they're released to continue that therapy. So that has actually already happened. So we've actually had that happen in our community. So there's definitely progress. You know, there's definitely a long ways to go, but we're really working on that as well.
Okay, and I do want to remind other listeners, if you do want to call in and ask a question, you can call us at 235-7721. You can also email us at info@kbbi.org. Please do include your name, so we know who is asking the question. That is kind of interesting, though, because like in talking to Cicada or talking to Philip Licht with Set Free Alaska, who is working to bring a residential treatment center here in town, it sounds like the criminal justice is definitely a large source for getting people towards treatment, whether it's mandated by their terms of release or not. But And this sounds like it's kind of on the front end in terms of when they first enter the criminal justice system, not when they're leaving it.
Yeah, totally. This is what we're hoping to, especially, you know, down here in Homer, you know, folks aren't usually here for very long. You know, if they're arrested here, they'll either get transferred up, or if they're planning on being released after a couple days. This is just a really quick, easy way to get people in and get them started on the help that they need while, you know, using that as an opportunity to get them somewhere entered into that pathway, right? And I know up the road, too, there are, I think it's through Cicada, and they're working on, I think they've already started doing some medication-assisted treatment on the way out, so folks can get, have the opportunity to have a Vivitrol injection.
To start before they leave
to
prison.
To start before they leave.
Can you explain what Vivitrol is?
So Vivitrol is another form of medication-assisted treatment that basically will help to keep them from craving the... you know, the opioids, and also will keep them from overdosing. So oftentimes when folks are incarcerated and they leave right away, if they're still struggling with addiction, if they're not getting the help they need, one of the first things they do is use, and they may use the same dose that they used prior to their incarceration, which leads to a lot of overdose deaths. So this medication will prevent that.
Okay. In the criminal justice system, you mentioned medicated-assisted treatment. If you want to kind of give a short overview of what that is for folks that who may not know, and can they continue that treatment in prison if they're serving some time?
So medication-assisted treatment is basically medication that really can help people get off of certain substances, especially heroin or opioids in general. So there's the use of Suboxone. Sublocade is a new injection form of Suboxone, and there's also Vivitrol. And so I'm not sure how, you know, if they're able to continue taking Suboxone up at once they...
That's a good question. I don't know that
either. That's a, yeah.
If you're using... the medicated assisted treatment and you end up in prison, that's a great question.
Yeah,
I don't
I'm
know.
Not sure. I would hope that that's the case, but I can't guarantee that that's happening.
And the other question that seemed to be in there was funding. And I think this is a good time to start talking about the Set Free's idea to bring a residential treatment center and kind of how, like, I think it's a good example of how the funding situation kind of works in terms of any of these kind of projects. So if you want to kind of explain what Set Free is proposing to do and how that funding mechanism of it is going to be working.
Sure. So Set Free Alaska is a residential treatment facility. They offer residential treatment and outpatient and intensive outpatient for folks struggling with substance use disorder. And they are based up in the Valley, and now they're looking to come down here in Homer. And so their plan as of right now, hopefully, is to have a residential treatment right here in Homer, right in town. They as far as funding, Jay, you might be able to better answer some of these questions.
Well, so part of the good news around funding is that our federal administration, President Trump, has acknowledged that the opioid crisis is an emergency and generated funding nationwide to help with the problem. That's good news. That money filters down to each of the states, and then the state has money set aside for that purpose and for that service within the state. And that is targeted, directed money. I do agree with Kristen. I'm not sure how that will all play out in our state going forward. We will see. But there is money that is currently set aside by previous year's budgets for the money going forward for this year and for the grant that I know Set Free is looking for and for some of the services that are already happening. There's money that can't be reallocated somewhere else. It's specifically for the opioid emergency.
Right.
That's good news. The downside is if more people are using or if they got the numbers, the data wrong, and we have more people that are using than we anticipated, or if treatment costs more than originally anticipated, is there going to be money to help that? That we will find out next week, I think, when the governor releases his new budget. I remain hopeful in spite of what it looks like, but I also understand the need to... I don't envy the job of people that control the money, because there is a lot of need, not just within our community, within our state. And to try and make a dime go as far as a dollar does, it's going to be very difficult. We rely on state grants and federal grants, agencies like mine, to provide funding. We rely on the goodness of people donating, like the Bearded Sister does, and making sure that they have money to do their events. So there is other things you can do as a community member in donating money or time to different organizations to help with those things. And that will help. Peer support is a good way of getting involved. So there's a few things you can do, but really we're kind of in a wait and see right now with our fingers crossed that that the budget isn't so slashed that it impacts the services that we can provide.
Right, and we do have another caller on the line. Art, you are on the coffee table. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, I'd like to point out that there has been a program, a federally funded program. Alaska was one of three states in the whole country that accepted $1 million a year to help with reentry so that there wouldn't be as much recidivism. And our current, and we're at least a year into that, but our current administration, state administration, has seen fit to return the funds for future on the premise, I understand, that we can't afford to continue the program after the grants run out. And this is going to affect a lot of people who have been involved and have had really good track record working with these folks. It seems to me that it's penny wise and pound foolish if we're going to have more recidivism. So I don't know if you know about that.
I hadn't heard that yet, but that's interesting. I'll look into that. Well, have you heard any of that, Stephanie, Aaron?
Well, no, but I do have a question, and thanks for your call, Art. I mean, I guess what we haven't really touched on is as far as reentry in Homer, you know, Hannah, if you want to kind of explain, like, I don't know if you want to take on this question specifically, or even Stephanie, what is available in terms of reentry? I mean, and what are some of the challenges that come along with that, reentering a community after going through treatment?
I mean, I don't know as much about some of the formal programs that are available. I do know that that's a very difficult path to walk because those are a lot of the calls that I get. You know, I've gotten messages from people that are a couple months into recovery, you know, have been through the criminal justice system and are really looking for increased community, but they haven't become a part of one of these, you know, reentry programs that are out there. So, you know, we're trying to create space to catch some of those folks and plug them into the community events that we do and the programs that we're building. But then as far as, I mean, it is just a really difficult period because you're relearning, I guess, how to live in a totally new lifestyle and finding connections in the community, meaningful work, friendships that are healthy, habits that are healthy. There's just a myriad of, you know, mind, body, wellness issues there to deal with.
What was the path you took?
For me, you know, I found a lot of peers that had been like, I'm 7 years sober. I'm an alcoholic. And I found a lot of peers that were also alcoholics living a sober life. And that was key for me, sitting peer to peer with another person that understood, you know, physically, mentally, spiritually, what I had been through. And then I found a million and one hobbies in Homer.
Nice.
So yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, you've gone through this yourself, but I mean, in terms of, I mean, did you go somewhere else for treatment and then return to the community? Or for the folks that are even doing that, I mean, what are some of the challenges they face when they return to the community where they were using? I mean, that's got to be quite challenging. And I think it's got to be quite a big decision whether or not to go back there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I didn't go through a treatment program. I chose to go to AA here in Homer. That was, you know, the option that I knew about. But I think it is really hard. I definitely know people that have been through treatment programs and then, you know, decided, am I going to go home? Am I going to go try to rebuild a different kind of life in Homer? And I've seen it happen over and over again. It is hard. It is daunting. But that's one of those keys about celebrating recovery, is trying to demonstrate to people that are in the midst of that decision and in the midst of trying to rebuild that life and how to do it, for them to see people that are celebrating their recovery and saying, you know, yes, it's possible, and I'm living well today, and welcome. I guess that's part of the message I'm trying to send. But that has to be partnered with, you know, these treatment programs and more formal programs that can really get people plugged into the resources that they need.
Totally. I agree. And I feel like I've heard stories of over the past few years of people whose children have gone to California for treatment or gone out of state somewhere for treatment or just even up north. And then they've returned back here and without, you know, then they're trying to tap into resources that are existing like at the center or Sakata, but because there's a wait or whatever. And as soon as they get here, they don't, you know, they don't have that person to call. So I think programs like, you know, what Hannah's got here with the Fit to Recover, like
it's a great
give us,
one. Yeah.
Give us a call anytime, you know, that's a person that can help you get through rather than connecting with your old people that are going to lead you back into that lifestyle that you were just away from. So, you know, I feel is great about having extra peer support. And Inilchik now has peer support people that are down here in Homer, and it's amazing. Like I can see so much positive just from having peer support folks in Homer now. Now we have, you know, a couple of peer support from Inilchik and then the Fit to Recover program, which has been awesome. I think there's, you know, that was one common theme with the task force was that we needed a one number or a one person or a person to get a hold of at any time. And now our community has that. We have people, that people are available at any time.
All right. And we do have another caller on the line. Alan, you are on the cap table. Go ahead with your question.
Yeah, good morning. I don't have a question so much as I've been listening, and I super appreciate your guys' time and you're really knowledgeable about this issue. And I was kind of compelled to call because of some of the callers and the funding issue. And I think what might be something to think about is more along the lines of not what we can't get, but what we want and how we want to deal with this issue as a community. And I think you guys are really leading the community down that path. And I think that's more my question. It's not necessarily what the current administration is doing or not doing. And it's more about the work that you guys are bringing to the table. And so I super appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Alrighty, thanks for the call, Alan.
I think Alan has a good point. I think one of the things that is important about this disease is once again recognizing that it's a disease. And the sooner people can recognize substance abuse, misuse as a disease, and know that there is treatment, recovery, and life continuing after you've had this disease, it changes the way you think about it. You don't think about it as those people over there doing the thing that makes them bad. You think of it as, oh my God, look what happened to that person. How can we help them get better? And there is something to that. If you think about it differently, the funding changes because now it's just a health issue. Right. You can go talk to your doctor. You can go talk to your therapist. And without any feelings of being less or being bad, you can say, I'm struggling with addiction. And they say, you know what? We've got some treatment for that. And I've got some people you can talk to. Come on in. And you don't feel pushed aside or marginalized or like you have somehow failed. Even the term behavioral health, when we talk about this service, is so demeaning in my mind. It's somehow that you did something so horribly wrong when the fact is you are genetically predisposed to having a disease the same way I might be genetically predisposed to getting cancer or diabetes later in life. Some people are predisposed to having addiction as their disease, and it's all it is. It's a disease.
Yeah. And so I think the one word that kind of sums it up is stigma. And Stephanie, we were talking about this earlier before our calls. And in terms of the community conversation, there's one coming up on February, you said 16th, is that right?
Yep.
And kind of explain, you know, some of the idea behind this is to try to reduce some stigma. And,
yep.
And how are these community conversations kind of doing that?
So I think any opportunity for people to engage in conversations about addiction and recovery is important because it shouldn't be something that we don't talk about because it does affect all of us. Everyone is affected by addiction, whether you have an addiction or somebody you love has an addiction. I mean, it affects our community. It affects everything. And I think that this upcoming conversation, I really want to have the community come and share their voice, and it's going to be a community-driven event, so all discussions are I'm not coming there with any preset agendas. So you guys need to come and come with your ideas and how what we're going to talk about for the day. But I really want this to be a day that people can connect the dots and see that everybody is affected and how we're all connected and that everybody can be part of the solution. And if it's as simple as just learning how to talk about it and have these conversations and how to talk about, you know, addiction as a disease or, you know, that there's hope and recovery and it's not all about, you know, this doom and gloom stuff. There's a whole lot of life outside of that. And I think this conversation, my hope is that we empower the people in the community to step up and not rely on the state and the federal funding to take care of, you know, any of this, because it's our problem and all of us have a way that we can, you know, help out. You know, look at, you know, what Hannah and her crew did with the Bearded Sister. They're just some community members that had a passion and they're stepping up. And, you know, we've got the folks that started the parent-to-parent support group and all of the things that have come out of that, you know, all the different events and all of the positive stories and, you know, connections. And, you know, I'm just really excited because, you know, I think this task force started out as an agency-based thing, but I don't think that that's where it needs to live. I think it needs to live in the community. And I've been excited to see that there's been a lot more community members getting engaged and maybe not attending the task force meetings every month, but somehow being involved and just helping with decreasing stigma and increasing these conversations about addiction. And I really hope to see that people come to this event ready with their ideas and their passions, and we as a task force and as a community can help empower each other to step up and find actionable items and actionable things that they can do to help.
Right. And I do want to actually get to how people can get in touch with you folks here in a minute. We just have about 11 minutes left. And again, that event is at February 16th at the Christian Community Church. What is the time?
From 12 to 5. We're going to have lunch. So lunch is, we're going to open up the doors around 11:45 so people can come in and get some food and then get, you know, get comfortable and seated. And
what are we having for lunch?
I believe we're going to have a lovely assortment of platters from Two Sisters. So okay. I will confirm with you. Just in case that changes,
and
it's going to be good.
We do have one more caller, Willie, we'll get to in just a second. But you kind of mentioned what you want people that come to these conversations to kind of go home with is kind of this new ability to talk about this issue and kind of the idea of reducing stigma. But, I mean, how is this valuable for the task force? What does the task force come away with these events?
Well, I think that, you know, my dream is that, you know, I love doing what I'm doing and I love facilitating this group and moving it forward, but I would love that it would be something sustainable outside of just me being the leader. I want other people to get engaged in it just to kind of flow naturally and just keep living on without me. But also, I think that from this, we're really going to be able to see and hear what our community needs are, you know, what the people are saying now, what the themes are. So I really want to be able to, you know, learn a lot more. So I'm hoping, you know, the first community town hall was, you know, in an evening, and then the second was during the day on a weekday, and now this one's on a weekend. So I'm really trying to get more people, as many people engaged as possible. So...
All right. And Willie, you are on the coffee table. Go ahead with your question. Oh, looks like, see if we can get you on here. Having problems with our machine. Willie, are you there? Oh, looks like we're having some.
While you're looking for Willie, I'll tell you another way to get rid of stigma is talk to Hannah or or someone else that's in recovery, and not just in recovery, but celebrating recovery, because you'll be caught up in how invested they are in being better. And you'll recognize that it's not someone that wants to sit at home alone in their room and drink. It's someone that wants to be better. So talking to people is a huge way to stop that stigma. You realize that people are people. And
yeah,
I don't know.
And I got into this, you know, wanting to reduce stigma and wanting to help people. And what I'm loving is learning about how all these things are interconnected. you know, like Fit to Recover and some of these peer support programs and the way we celebrate recovery, it's not just helping people reenter and helping people, you know, rebuild and heal, but it's also prevention. You know, it kind of comes full circle back to, you know, sending a message to the youth and kids in our community and the families that are on the cusp of that struggle, that there's another way. And so I love that it can serve both of those roles.
All right. And hopefully, maybe I got Willie. Willie, are you online too?
Well, hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Great. Hey, thanks for the conversation. It's really, really important, really good conversation to have. Thanks, everybody there. Just wanted to remind folks, and it was mentioned briefly earlier in the program, but as far as peer support and celebrating recovery, for people struggling with alcohol, there's Alcoholics Anonymous, which meets in town every day. On weekdays, there's three meetings a week, and on weekends, there's two meetings a week. So every day of the year, 365 days a year, it's free, open to anybody who wants to just stop by and check it out. It's a group of people who have struggled with alcohol addiction but are celebrating happy, sober lives now. And there's hundreds of folks in town who have recovered from, you know, what they felt like was a hopeless situation. You can check out AA.org, or there's a 24/7 hotline. Anybody who wants to talk to somebody about their alcohol problem, 283-5722. That's 24/7 hotline. And, you know, the opioid addiction is terrible. But we need to remember that twice as many people die from alcohol abuse every year as from opioids, and so that's an ongoing problem. But there's a lot of hope, a lot of recovery in town, and AA is a great peer support group.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Willie.
Yeah, thanks, Willie.
You know, and he did make a good point there. And in terms of the you know, the residential treatment center with Set Free, if that does mm-hmm. come to reality, Philip Licht has said that they'll treat everyone. This is not just for opioids.
Right.
And these other services translate to these other types of ailments.
It's all for all substances. I think our task force name is the Opioid Task Force, but that doesn't mean we are only talking about opioids. That just happens to be what was happening at that time,
the catalyst.
Yeah, but really everything that we're talking about and doing and working for is for all substances. You know, medication assisted treatment maybe specifically a little bit more geared toward certain substances, but we're talking about everything.
And the same goes for the, you know, peer support issues that I work on. You know, our policy is very open door. You know, it doesn't matter what type of substance or addictive behavior your issue is focused around. You know, we really welcome people that are struggling.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we have just about 5 minutes left, and I did want to touch on this a little bit. We're talking about stigma in these community conversations. But you know, there are a lot of these conversations that happen online, and I've seen this actually unfold. Stephanie, you're a brave soul, reaching out to people on social media, because you never know what you're going to get. But if you want to explain, you know, these community conversations are, do you think you're attracting people that are already plugged into this idea that they already want to help, which is great in its own sense, but also, you know, is it reaching the people that you're trying to reduce that mm-hmm. harbor that stigma that you're trying to target?
Yeah, I think in general, you know, the people who show up are the ones who have, you know, historically been the ones already engaged or have some type of, you know, connection or really want. But I really would like to reach all these people. You know, when I'm searching through Homer Communications and on Facebook and replying to a lot of interesting comments on there. You know, one of the things that I always make sure I do is offer people, like, I will buy you a cup of coffee and let's connect and actually talk face to face, because I think that's got some pretty significant value to it. You know, if we can connect and talk in real life, you know, just to even do that and maybe have some good conversations that are.
And one of the things we're trying to do is with our DSDIG series, is the idea of showing movies for free at the movie theater where you can come get a popcorn and a soda, and we're just going to show a movie and we're going to talk about the movie. You, as the audience, do not have to particularly engage, but you can be there and hear part of that conversation. And the idea is taking a look at popular movies with starring Ryan Gosling or starring, you know, the big stars in the big movies, and really how they tie back into things like substance abuse and mental illness. So you can participate without necessarily being the choir that we're already preaching to. And so that's part of our goal, too. And our next one's coming up at the end of this month on the 28th, and we'll be showing Half Nelson in conjunction with the Opioid Task Force. So if you want to, come on out.
All right. Lots going on this month.
Well, great. And I do want to provide an opportunity for folks who want to connect to the Opioid Task Force, or maybe even connect with Bearded Sister, if you want to kind of go down the line and start with Stephanie. How can folks plug into the task force more specifically for you, and then we'll kind of move down the line.
Sure. So the easiest way is the task force has an email that I have been monitoring to connect in is skpopioidtaskforce@gmail.com. Just shoot me an email. I'm happy to add you to the listserv. If you give me your phone number, I'll call. We can connect and...
All right. And Hannah, how can folks get in touch with the Bearded Sister?
Right now, the best way is just to get a hold of me, or you can find the Bearded Sister or me, Hannah Heimbach, on Facebook. Happy to take messages that way.
Okay. And Jay, I mean, I know folks can go to your physical building.
But... Walk right in. Ben Walters, and we are open 8:30 to 5, Monday through Friday for walk-ins. You don't need an appointment. Come on in and say hi. I need some help, and we'll get you going.
Okay, well, great. I want to thank all my guests. We have Stephanie Stillwell, who's the coordinator of Homer's Opioid Task Force, Hannah Heimbach, who leads the Bearded Sister, or maybe not leads. I don't know if I'm giving you too much of a title there with the group. And we have Jay Bechdel, the executive director of South Peninsula Behavioral Health. Thanks, all of you guys.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Joining us.
Thank you.